You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, pregnant women on Medicaid would have more access to midwives and doulas under a proposal in Congress. Wisconsin Representative Gwen Moore joins the show to tell us about the plan. First, do your summer plans involve air travel? If so, we've got some bad news. This was a recent headline on Bloomberg's website. A summer from hell is coming to U.S. airports. In short, there are three big reasons for a potential problem: a lot of passengers, a lack of planes, and a possible shortage of airport screeners. Last week, United announced it's canceling more than 2,400 flights for June and July. American says it's calling off 115 per day. So what's going on and what can passengers do about it? Justin Bachman is an aviation and aerospace reporter at Bloomberg. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Well, before we get into the three separate reasons, big picture sounds bad. What could this look like as we're trying to travel in airports this summer?
Well, we kind of focused on the worst case scenario, and it's not true that that necessarily will come to pass, but it is a possibility. And I think at this point, enough airlines and airports are nervous about what could happen with these three areas that it's something that's, you know, worth talking about for sure.
Let's break down now the three different factors feeding into this. First, a lot of us fly in the summer. That's no secret. And it seems like maybe more than usual this summer.
Yeah, this is going to be a record summer, according to the airlines trade group, Airlines for America. And, you know, for 10 years, that number has been rising each summer. And it's truly the case where travel has become just, you know, a critical part of, you know, Americans' lifestyles, and especially in the summer when kids are out of school. So that's, you know, that's adding a lot of stress in the summer. There's just no slack in the system. All the seats are taken. The airports are all full. And I think that's, you know, what is laying over the top of this issue about, you know, the MAX being grounded and the fact that some transportation security officers could be sent for duty at the Mexican border.
Let's talk about that MAX now, the Boeing 737 MAX. In the few news a few months ago after those tragic crashes, it looks like we're going to be without that particular aircraft as they evaluate its safety. What is the latest on that?
Right. The FAA is still looking at some proposed software changes that Boeing is making in the system so that it's not as pronounced in that software that pitched the plane down in certain situations. That all has to be worked through. And, you know, I think right now that the FAA is just beginning to look at the technical changes that Boeing is making, as well as what kind of changes will be needed in pilot training that's expected to come, you know, as part of this whole revamp for the system. So that, you know, that's kind of where it is now. But for airlines, that means they're not going to get this plane probably until the end of the summer. August is where the big three airlines that have the MAX in the U.S. have put, you know, they're planning from early to mid-August. So, and it could be later than that. So we'll have to see.
Obviously, safety is the primary concern there. But that said, with this particular model of plane off the market, how big a factor is the Boeing 737 MAX in our domestic air fleet?
Well, that, I think, is the good news in all of this. There were only 72 airplanes flying before the grounding happened in early March. So in terms of real numbers, it's not anything like you would see if this issue had affected the entire 737 fleet, which is, you know, truly the workhorse along with Airbus. So right now, it's really five dozen airplanes that we're talking about. That's manageable, but at the same time, it's a real number of people that have to be reaccommodated. And when you take that many, you know, at the busiest time of the year, that's where it can kind of snowball for a lot of the airlines.
Right. As you said, there wasn't a lot of slack to begin with going into the summer, even with those planes.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, we think about Thanksgiving and Christmas as big travel holidays, but really the average Friday in July or August is much, much busier than that. So summer is when the U.S. airport and aviation system is really running it at full throttle.
Talking to Justin Bachman, aviation and aerospace reporter at Bloomberg, about possible problems in air travel this summer because of a few different reasons. Let's get to that third one now. Justin, you touched on this a bit earlier. The Department of Homeland Security is thinking about taking resources away from the Transportation Security Administration, some of the people who work there presumably, and sending them to U.S.-Mexico border. What are we hearing about that?
Right. The DHS is looking for staffing to send to the border. The Trump administration has made a very concerted focus on what they call a border crisis of immigration. And so they're looking for as many as 400 airport screener staff to volunteer and would go down there. It's not entirely clear what they would do at the border, since the training that they get for the airport is not really the Customs and Border Protection training. It's also not clear what that would cost in terms of, you know, sending that many people down there for what would be probably a temporary assignment. So I don't think it's been decided at this point, and there are a lot of people in Congress asking a lot of critical questions about this idea. But, you know, it's one of those things that if you're running a big airline or you're a big airport, you get a little nervous about the idea that maybe some of that screening staff will not be there over the summer.
400 screeners nationwide, it doesn't sound like that big a number, but where is the TSA when it comes to, again, that idea of slack? Do they have a lot of wiggle room there?
They really don't. I mean, the TSA has never been an agency where the funding has gone to a lot of the personnel at the airport. It's done a lot of equipment. It's done a lot of things. But, you know, staffing has never been what you would call overly large. As part of this debate, there is a proposal in Congress to add more than $1 billion in funding for Customs and Border Protection because the administration wants to get more people at the border. So I think a lot of efforts are being made to pass that money, get new agents there at the border, and then maybe not have the TSA do that kind of work.
Have we heard reactions from airlines or representatives of pilots or flight attendants to this idea, again, not a done deal, of taking TSA screeners, putting them on the border?
Yes, the flight attendants have been very vocal that this is a bad idea in their view. And I think that the airlines and the airport associations have said similar, but their focus has been to press for the funding in Congress for the CBP as a way to have, you know, the TSA be kind of left alone in this debate. So I think some of the unions are critical of the administration. Others are being a little bit more circumspect and saying, let's get money for the border, and then we don't have to really fight about what the TSA is doing.
You mentioned the possible worst case scenario if all of these things are in place at once. How likely is it, though, do you think that we'll have this worst case, mass amounts of travel, short some planes, and these screeners taken off duty?
Well, it's tricky to game out what a percentage would be. I mean, of all three of those happening together, possibly not. But we know that the crowds are going to be, you know, filling the airports. The demand is there. The tickets are being sold. It's more likely or more unlikely that the airports will be jammed with long lines because of the TSA staffing problems. I think Congress is focused on that issue, and you're going to see a lot of pressure come to bear that not happen.
Do you have thoughts for people maybe making those summer travel plans now as summer kicks off?
Well, you know, the typical advice that you always hear is the really good advice of get there early and give yourself time to deal with any sort of problems that may come up, whether that's, you know, with your ticket or your boarding pass or getting through the security line or having your gate changed two or three times by the airline. It's just a case where, because there are so many people and because it's such a kind of a stress-filled time, it's better to come and approach it in a more leisurely manner, I think, than to try to rush yourself through.
We'll leave it there for now. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Justin Bachman, aviation and aerospace reporter at Bloomberg. We talked to them about some possible snags in air travel this summer. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The nation faces a big disparity when it comes to health and childbirth. Black women and newborns in particular are more likely to die during or after childbirth than white women and newborns. A new bill in Congress aims to help tackle that problem by providing more access to two kinds of health care providers, midwives and doulas. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore is the author of the new legislation. She represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District in Milwaukee. Representative Moore, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Rob. So good to be with you.
What exactly would your new bill do?
What my bill would do would be to expand Medicaid reimbursements to doulas and midwives. and give states that provide, all states that provide Medicaid, the ability to reimburse them for their health care services. We think places where Medicaid has been expanded and places where doulas have been reimbursed really demonstrate, Rob, that there is a reduction in adverse consequences, infant mortality and maternal and infant mortality. And we think that that's something worth funding.
Can you talk about the role of the doula? That may not be a familiar word to everybody.
A doula is like a midwife. I mean, this is an ancient profession. Back before we had the sophisticated healthcare system that we have now, midwives and doulas delivered babies regularly. And during slavery, doulas delivered birth for the white women as well as the slaves on the plantation. They are supporters. They don't deliver the babies, but what they do is really provide the support and the health care, the advice about diet, even positions to make you more comfortable during the delivery, and they're advocates.
You released this bill, the Mama's First Act, at a press conference with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. Can you talk about how this issue, these disparities when it comes to health and childbirth, are affecting the Milwaukee area?
Well, you know, it is really an embarrassment, Rob. We have maternal mortality that is three times that of white women. We really rival women in war-torn areas like Afghanistan for maternal and infant mortality. And in the richest country in the world, how do you explain that? We've looked at this. And the dearth of healthcare and healthcare providers is one solution, is one problem. Another problem is that often women of color are not taken very seriously when they're communicating with their healthcare providers. Doulas are people who can actually go to the healthcare appointments with you, can help a woman negotiate the kinds of questions that she needs to ask, help them with follow through and making sure that they make all of their appointments. This would be a particularly important tool in the toolkit when we know that there are many at-risk pregnancies within our community. We're not proud of it, but Wisconsin is one of the places that for decades had been at the top of the list of teen pregnancies. And so we know that teen moms are not always educated, and doulas are a really good intervention in making sure we have good birth outcomes.
We're talking to U.S. Congressional Representative Gwen Moore. She's the author of a new bill, the Mama's First Act, aimed at using Medicaid coverage to provide more access to doulas and midwives for women around the country. Milwaukee has a pilot program in place trying to expand access to doulas. What have you seen going on there?
We are so proud of the experimental program we've seen at 53206. We have actually seen it reduce, lowering of the tick with women who died during birth. We also have seen it reduce the numbers of C-sections that women experience. We think that women get into a healthcare system that is very busy, very impersonal, and that at the very first sign of any sort of problem, health institutions are eager to avoid liability or whatever, and by instantly, the go-to solution of cesarean sections. And I think that doulas can be very, very instrumental in making sure that people do exercises, that they understand their body, that they are with women. Very often, women go to the hospital as soon as they feel the first pain, and that's how they get into situations where they're about to have a C-section, because, if it's gone on for a couple of hours, there might be an inpatient factor. But doulas can help women remain calm, monitor the labor, and really assess and evaluate whether or not this is a labor that is progressing to a point that you can have a natural childbirth.
I know there are concerns for some healthcare providers and pharmacies that Medicaid reimbursements aren't always high enough for them to stay in business if that's all they do. What kind of levels are you looking at? What are you doing to make sure that this is sufficient to keep doulas in the area able to do this kind of work?
Well, you know, doulas are doing this work. And unfortunately, doulas are respected so much that people do private pay for doulas. I mean, they may have clients, and many, and most of them do have clients who are able to pay out of pocket, or they have health insurance coverage from private insurers that actually cover that. This, we hope that by expanding Medicaid coverage, we will be able to demonstrate with a dramatic lowering of maternal deaths that this would be something that all insurance companies would recognize would save monies in the long run. Even if it's just a matter of not having a woman go back and forth and back and forth to the hospital with false labor, that would save money right there. That's very expensive to admit a woman, you know, and only to tell her, go back home, you're not really in labor. And a doula can help someone do it. Now, with regard to Medicaid reimbursement, all of our providers are underfunded. So this is not this would not just be a problem for doulas, but the Medicaid reimbursement. We appreciate healthcare providers that really lean into taking care of vulnerable populations, even though they don't get the reimbursements that we think they deserve.
Are you getting bipartisan support for your new legislation yet?
Bipartisan support. Well, we are hoping that we can get bipartisan support. We are not giving up on that. This is not the only bill in the House that's related to really protecting mothers who are pregnant. And we're hoping to put this in some packages with other bills to do research on why, for example, women of color in this country are more subject to having adverse outcomes. Put it together with another piece of legislation that I have that would provide research dollars for sudden unexpected infant deaths. So we're hoping to build a critical mass of demand for these kinds of bills to get it over the finish line.
Now, we've had these disparities in health outcomes when it comes to childbirth for moms and newborns for quite a while now. Do you start to see people taking this more seriously? Do you see more calls to do something about this?
Yeah, we do see people on the ground wanting us to do something about it because, I mean, when you start having greater maternal deaths than you have in places like Afghanistan, it's just kind of the thing that makes you go, hmm. And it's concentrated in pockets of our community. We had a testimony in the Committee on Ways and Means from doctors, other healthcare professionals, public health experts, who really say that they believe, unfortunately, that racism is a real problem in healthcare for women. And of course, the outcomes, you know, when you lose a child or lose a mother are just too harsh to continue to ignore.
So what's the next step for this legislation, the Mama's First Act?
Well, the next step for the Mama's Act is to try to get it scheduled for the floor. But again, we would love for it to be packaged with other bills so that we can get the critical mass of support that we need for this initiative.
Representative Moore, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And you be well, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's U.S. Representative Gwen Moore from Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about new legislation that she's authored. It aims to provide access to midwives and doulas for women who are eligible for Medicaid, part of an effort to tackle disparities in health outcomes, a mortality gap, more Black women and newborns dying in or shortly after childbirth than other groups in the country. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For a lot of political junkies, a recent exchange on Twitter raised some eyebrows. Progressive Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York tweeted a call for an end to former lawmakers becoming lobbyists on Capitol Hill. Then from the opposite chamber and the opposite side of the political spectrum, conservative Republican Senator Ted Cruz tweeted that he was on board with the idea. From there, the two lawmakers said they would work together to see that a lifetime ban on corporate lobbying was passed. Other lawmakers have expressed interest in ending what seems like a lucrative revolving door for former politicians. Whether or not this actually sees the light of day, it did highlight the longstanding and uneasy relationship between money and power on Capitol Hill. Eleanor Powell is the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison. Eleanor, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is a pretty specific ban in its early stages. I don't think they're actually drafting legislation via Twitter right now. But can you talk about the potential impact of a ban like this?
So the idea that they came to is really one in response to this report that came out a couple of days ago that highlighted how many former members are becoming lobbyists. So from the last Congress, over half the former members who left office became lobbyists, and a number of others joined law firms and sort of related activities.
Is it possible, is it legal to ban a former member of Congress from doing a particular gig like this?
Well, so this is certainly a question. Currently, we have what are called cooling off periods. So former members of the House are prohibited from lobbying their colleagues for a year. Senators are prohibited of lobbying their colleagues for 2 years. So those have been legal, though I don't think they've been tested in the courts.
What is a lobbyist? Because that the answer to that question that seems simple could make a lot of difference here.
So this is a really important distinction. So commonly, if we're just talking and throwing the terms around, we think of a lobbyist as anyone who sort of advocates to the federal government on behalf of any cause. So that's the colloquial definition. The legal definition is really restrictive and in practice is filled with loopholes. So legally, you're only a lobbyist if more than 20% of your time is representing a single client, and you have to have earned certain amounts of money and other sorts of things. So there's all sorts of loopholes there. If you 19.9% of your time is for a single client, you don't have to register as a lobbyist.
Right. If I leave Congress, assuming I'd been in Congress, and become the vice president of outreach for this company or this think tank or something like that, and I'm not exactly lobbying most of that time, it might not look that different to a member of the public. It would look different to the law.
Exactly. That's one of the strategic advice loopholes. So essentially, as long as you're not directly talking to your members of Congress, you're just advising your colleagues who are lobbyists, it doesn't count as lobbying.
The core issue that has people worried about is the influence of money in politics. The idea that, hey, is my member of Congress just angling for that sweet lobbying gig when they leave office? Is this something that really affects the legislation that ends up coming out of Congress?
It's a really difficult question to answer. I would say there have been studies that show that lobbyists, when there's a revolving door lobbyist, someone who used to work in Congress joins the team, that stuff gets passed at a much higher rate. They're much more effective than sort of regular lobbyists, which is really suggestive that it could be influencing the process.
Now, a door revolves two ways. How about lobbyists who go in and become congressional staffers or White House advisors?
That happens, too, and we see that happen. And, you know, again, it at least creates an appearance of a conflict of interest. Whether they're actually still working on behalf of their former clients or not is difficult to assess.
A lot of people talk about lobbyists as inherently bad guys, I think. Janice on Facebook writes, lobbying should be outlawed altogether. But I think a lot of people might say, well, if I think this way on an issue, that environmental group has a lobbyist. If you're an environmentalist, you might support that. That business group, if you're a small business person, you might like that lobbyist. Is lobbying really a dirty word?
Well, it has this sort of pejorative connotation, but I guarantee you, regardless of your political views, where you are on the ideological spectrum, there's some type of lobbyist advocating on your behalf for issues that you care about. That may not be equally distributed, but there's definitely a wide range of opinions there. And, you know, the sort of right to petition the federal government is sort of enshrined in the Constitution.
We're talking to Eleanor Powell. She's the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison, looking at lobbying and Congress. A new, at least via Twitter, possible piece of legislation coming from someone on the left and someone on the right with the idea of banning members of Congress from becoming lobbyists after they leave office. A lifetime ban is what they're kicking around on Twitter. Have we heard an effort to do that before?
We have. Actually, they're not the first to propose this. So Colorado Senator Michael Bennett and his Republican counterpart, Cory Gardner, have already have legislation that proposes something similar. I think Elizabeth Warren have proposed something similar. So they're not the first, but this is definitely the most attention the idea has ever gotten.
If it just bans a former senator or representative from becoming the thing that we legally define as a lobbyist, but leaves a lot of that wiggle room there, is it more symbolic?
It actually just pushes the activity under the rug and makes it harder to study and sort of reduces transparency. So there are separate efforts to try to improve transparency and sort of tighten up these lobbying rules. So H.R. 1, which passed the House, the sort of For the People Act, which tries to sort of tighten up a bunch of ethical rules, tries to limit the sort of strategic advice loophole and some of these other sorts of things. But so far, the Senate has taken no action on that.
I've seen an argument, I think it's from Matt Iglesias, the political writer, who says, come at this from the other angle. The problem, as he sees it, the core problem is that congressional offices are under-resourced compared to the resources that lobbyists have. He says, pay members of Congress and their staff more, give them more money to have a robust staff so that they contend on a level playing field with influential, well-funded lobbyists. Is that something we've seen tried?
It's something that we haven't really seen change very much, but it's definitely something that's proposed. Members of Congress, you know, relative to what they could be earning in the private sector as lobbyists, earn a small fraction of them that amount in office, and their staff is paid pitifully relative to their outside earning potential. And so you have, you know, a lot of 20-somethings who are poorly paid writing the laws, and so they don't have the expertise in a bunch of policy areas and just the technical knowledge that lawmaking requires that the lobbyists provide to the lawmakers.
It seems hard to imagine a member of Congress raising the banner, hey, we need to pay us more and our staff more.
It's politically toxic. Instead, they always are talking about sort of cutting their pay. But, you know, you could make an argument that the sort of net good could potentially outweigh the sort of net, you know, tax cost.
There's a lot of attention to different angles of money and politics, whether it's hiring former members of Congress to become lobbyists or lobbyists to work at the White House, whether it's campaign donations of various sorts, changes in the Supreme Court. A lot of our callers say it's the main issue of our time. How important is the issue of money in politics these days?
It affects a lot of different things. One of the, I think, the most concerning things that it affects is that it affects citizens' views and the faith of their government. It creates this sort of appearance of a potential conflict of interest, and this idea that citizens can't trust that their representatives are sort of fairly advocating on their behalf. And so if nothing else, even if it affected no other outcome, that would be sort of one reason that would be pretty serious in terms of making a change.
But it seems like an issue where a lot of people feel like it's kind of bad, but it hasn't become that one motivating issue that, say, gun rights is for some people, abortion rights, the environment is for some people. It's on the list. It's not at the top of their list.
Exactly. And if you ask people for several years, again, people are sort of concerned about it, but it never sort of rises to the top, even though people are concerned about corruption and conflict in Washington and members of Congress. So maybe this will be the year where we start to sort of see some change.
But it's a lot of efforts in the past seem to be kind of in the squeezing the water balloon phenomenon. McCain-Feingold shuts down stuff over here and it just pushes all the money over here.
I mean, exactly. And certainly that would be likely to happen again. You sort of tighten up some areas and then, you know, people find a way to influence things through areas that haven't been tightened up and the sort of process continues. And it's, you know, it's always a trouble with the Supreme Court as well. The court struck down a lot of past efforts that have tried to rein in money in politics.
Now, when it comes to this congressional lobbying issue, we heard from Leslie on the Ideas Network Facebook page. She pointed to former House Speaker John Boehner, who's now with the group that's promoting marijuana legalization. She writes, the problem is that the lawmakers have all the inside info and use it to their advantage. They should be banned, but they get around it by setting up phony companies or using family members, friends, etc. It's so corrupt. So, yeah, even if they're, again, not that legal lobbyist, that their inside knowledge gives them a lot of advantages.
Exactly. They know their former colleagues. Even if they aren't officially using those connections, they can advise their colleagues, you know, here's this person's weakness. Here's the best way to persuade this person. Here's the way to sort of work through the system. And that advice is invaluable.
Talking to Eleanor Powell right now. She's the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison. She's with us to talk about money in politics and a proposal discussed via Twitter between Democratic U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Republican Senator Ted Cruz. It would prevent members of Congress from becoming lobbyists when they leave office forever. bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Madison. Jake, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to push back a little bit on the idea that we should just give more money to the senators and representatives and their staff in order to combat how influential the lobbying industry is. If we tamp down lobbyists and we would elect people who, instead of being, for the vast majority of our federal representatives, they're lawyers, if we started to get people who are scientists or engineers, people who have the expertise in those fields already, and then most of the laws are done in committees first, so those are supposed to be people who are experts in a given area or spend most of their time in a policy area, so they should become experts over time as they work on those areas. So it's like, I don't think we should compete on a money level, because that's just going to escalate, so we should tamp it down and use experts.
Jake, thanks for the call. So Jake wants to see people from different walks of life bringing their experience to some of these issues.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for sort of bringing in more experience, more knowledge, more sort of electing more substantive policy representatives. And over different periods of American history, we've seen sort of more or less substantive representation of people with technical expertise. You know, it's still pretty tough in terms of lawmaking to have like the level of technical expertise, even within sort of a broad subject area, to sort of write the minutia of the laws on lots of different topics within a committee. But, you know, gaining expertise over time in Congress, that is sort of one advantage to having members there longer. We often think about, you know, the bad sides of having people stay in office longer, but there are sort of technical expertise advantages to that sort of accumulation of knowledge over time.
Even at the local level, I've heard of city council members saying, yeah, I was really getting the ropes of how this law writing stuff and ordinance writing stuff works around the end of my first term.
Yeah, it takes a long time to sort of figure out the ropes of both how to navigate the process of lawmaking, but then also to sort of learn the sort of technical knowledge in a bunch of different subject areas.
Jake, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. When it comes to lobbying, though, are former members of Congress really the dominant group of lobbyists? Most of them are coming from outside of Congress to begin with, right?
Yeah, so there's also a number of like former congressional staffers who become lobbyists, and that's a sort of similar path towards lobbying. Again, they have a similar dynamic. They have a lot of personal connections from the former member, from the senator or House member that they work for. They know how to work the system. They've gained some policy expertise. And so there are obviously more staffers, and so you see a lot of them go into lobbying as well, outnumbering the number of members who go in.
Is there a right way to do this? Are we ever going to arrive at a solution that says, yeah, we feel pretty good about how Congress is working and how they relate to lobbyists and the money coming in? Or is it just inherently going to be a little messy?
It's inherently a little complicated and a little messy. I mean, it's tough to sort of fully limit all of the possible ways of influence. But, you know, there are some of these suggestions that, you know, potentially could at least, you know, either improve the transparency or sort of reduce the potential for conflict of interest. Again, sort of potentially reducing the cynicism among voters.
Let's talk about the transparency side of things. What kind of mechanisms are in place so we know who's lobbying whom?
Well, so right now there are rules where you have to report essentially if you or a lobbyist that qualifies under this very narrow definition, you have to report that you lobbied Congress on some very general topic. You don't have to report which member you lobbied. You don't have to really report exactly the specifics of the bills or the issues that you were lobbying on. So even those things, you could just sort of improve the transparency there, both by expanding the number of people who have to report lobbying, but then also give some more details about which members of Congress you're lobbying or sort of exactly which bills and topics you're lobbying about.
We've talked on the show before about a ProPublica report, I think it was, that found that a lot of state legislation was being written by lobbyists or national groups that advocate on behalf of industries. Is that the kind of thing that also happens at the national level in Congress?
Yeah. I mean, you see a lot of these different lobbying groups or sort of industry groups, you know, are drafting legislation or drafting amendments to legislation and sort of passing that over to members, trying to educate them on sort of what they want. And sometimes you see that exact text of bills or exact amendment text end up in the sort of final outcome of what Congress passes.
We are talking about the influence of money and politics and a plan in Congress that would potentially ban members of Congress from lobbying once they leave the institution. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that idea. We have Eleanor Powell with us, political scientist at UW-Madison. Let's bring on another caller now. Steve is with us in Fitchburg. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to
mention a couple groups that are in Wisconsin that are doing work on this. I know United to Amend has done a lot of work on Citizens United work, but specifically more about lobbying. There's a chapter of Represent Us, which has a whole platform of lobbying and other corruption in politics that I think is definitely worth taking a look at. I know there's a chapter in Madison that people get involved with. They're on Facebook. They're findable. They've got a strategy for getting stuff done over the next couple election cycles if people are interested in that.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And I know at least one of those groups has gotten local initiatives, advisory referenda on ballots around the state and I assume elsewhere in the country. Are you seeing a movement like that out there?
Yeah, I'd say that there's sort of renewed energy on this subject. This sort of seems to happen maybe every 10 or 20 years that, you know, the last push to reform these things has sort of faded and it's been watered down through various court efforts and sort of creativity among folks seeking to influence the system. And it does seem like we're due for another round of efforts. There's sort of substantial momentum on many parts.
But given what you said earlier about the courts rejecting a lot of these kind of efforts, one of the initiatives you talked about is move to amend, not move to make a law, but actually amend the Constitution to take away some of those court objections.
I mean, this is the inherent challenge. The sort of freedom of speech protections, the freedom to sort of petition the federal government make it really tough to legislate these things. And so that what we've seen in the past is Congress passes some laws and then they get sort of watered down or somewhat struck down in the courts. And so it's not implausible to see a similar pattern here. That said, you know, you still strengthen the laws a little bit through that process. Maybe it just doesn't go as far as the legislators intended.
I think we have time for another caller. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I think this is a great idea. And as a matter of fact, I think lobbyists should be just completely banned and undone because then our politicians would have to listen to us, we the people. I mean, how's that for a concept?
Cindy, thanks for the call. Get rid of lobbyists, listen to the people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's always a tough distinction between sort of constituents, you know, persuading their member of Congress and sort of paid lobbyists. It, you know, that's a different idea of how to sort of transform the system. It's sort of bad paid lobbying and sort of only have sort of voluntaristic lobbying by sort of citizens talking to their elected officials.
Have there been efforts to just have better mechanisms for communication between constituents and their elected officials?
So there are a lot of different forums available that actually a lot of voters don't know about. So, you know, you can send a comment to your member on their webpage. You can tweet at them. You can write comments on their Facebook. You can write them letters. You can send phone calls. And so there are a lot of existing channels. Whether or not they listen to those messages and sort of take that feedback into account is a different question.
Right. I think that's what a lot of people worry that, okay, if I'm not a big donor or connected in some way to this politician, do they listen to that call? Am I just wasting my breath?
Well, and that's always the concern, right? The sort of cynicism concern and the sort of reason to sort of try to, you know, champ this system down to try to encourage faith in the process.
What are you going to watch for as Ted Cruz and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez maybe advance this Twitter-birthed legislation?
Well, I think it really hinges on the Senate. We've already seen the House pass some, you know, pretty sweeping ethics reforms, including some lobbying reform, and there are no votes scheduled in the Senate. So it's really a question of whether Senator Cruz can get Senator McConnell on board to really, you know, make this process move through the system.
We'll leave it there for now. Eleanor, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eleanor Powell. She's the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us today to talk about a potential bipartisan plan that would prevent members of Congress from becoming lobbyists when they leave office. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that and other issues of influence, money, and politics. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what you think.